We've got one of the first of the premier pickers and guitarists in this country and around the world joining us here live on the air. And hi, good morning to you, Leo Kottke.
Good morning.
And, well, we first of all want to remind folks that you are coming to the Crest Theaters, because it's coming Friday night. And Up West Productions bringing you in, and Leo, I know one of the things that you like to do is perform live. Obviously, this must be true because you've been doing it for how long now?
Oh man, 40 years, I suppose. They started paying me in about 68.
And one of the things, I guess, one of the things I think that would be interesting is, how many guitars do you own?
Oh, well, that's so interesting. I usually don't reveal the figure. Something happened, though. It isn't that I just accumulate guitars. It's that the guitar you just heard there with the Greyhound was stolen the night that I finally met up with John Fahey, who owned the record label that put that record out. And that guitar, I had refinished it. I had refinished it with raw linseed oil, which is an old and thoroughly discredited idea about instrument refinishing. And somehow on that guitar it worked, and it developed a sound that I haven't heard since. It was an extraordinary instrument, and the attempt to replace it is still going on. I think if I ever got it back, I'd drive over it with a truck. You just never should fall in love with a guitar, because they will go away, and you won't get over it. So as a result, I developed this, I was convinced that I could hear a diamond in the rough. That if I, and generally, my great inspiration was to take wood out of the guitar. There was some sense to that, because 12 strings were overbuilt back then. And so I'd go in there with a pocket knife and a perfectly random approach to luthiery and ruin what began life as a kind of crummy guitar in the first place. So I have a lot of guitars that are basically spare parts. I suppose if you wanted to, I can't remember the figure. I think I have about 10 guitars that are actually good instruments.
And of course, you play both a 6-string and 12-string, correct?
Yeah,
and a dumb question, I suppose. The answer is 6 strings. What's the difference between playing 6 and 12 string guitar?
It's probably the size of the thing, the bottom end. Traditionally the 12-string is tuned down below concert pitch, so it's something like the orbo is to the lute. It's had several courses, and some of them, the Baroque lute, for example, had some very low notes, but the Teorbo had a neck, I should know this, it's something like 6 feet long, and you played it in a vertical position, otherwise you'd perforate the rest of the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had a magnificent sound, one that you'll get hooked on and you'll regret it ever after, because they're hard to deal with.
Now, do your fingers ever get tired of playing guitar?
When they do, they let you know.
They do.
In ways that tell you to change your technique. So no is kind of the short answer.
Okay, but because I mean, 40 years of doing what you do, and then, you know, that's a lot of strumming.
Yeah, and there is a difference between performance and every other kind of playing you might be able to do. You can practice, or you can just be a guitar nut for your entire life and never never learn what you learn on stage. It does something every night that you can't get anywhere else. For you're playing and to you're playing. You have to learn all kinds of unwritten rules about how to do it. And then you'll keep doing it this is a tautology, but if you really want to do it, there's no problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
For me, if it were still the trombone, which is the instrument I started on, I wouldn't be doing it because that's not what I was designed to be playing. But the guitar came along and was an answer to every question I ever had, and still is.
So you started out playing trombone. What made you want to go to the guitar?
I'd been sick for a long time and was not supposed to sit up, and was living in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and those all kind of go together.
All right.
My mother brought home a toy guitar because you can't play a trombone flat on your back. And that was it. I made up an E chord, as it turned out. I didn't know what it was. Strummed it, and even with that guitar, which was a joke, I got it. I sat up. I remember the weather, the day, everything about it, and I knew what I was going to do for the rest of my life. I had no idea what I would do, for a living, and I couldn't have cared less. I knew that I found what I wanted. And then it became a job, sort of, really, by default, over time.
And again, when did you first record? Was that through John Fahey?
The very first thing was for the Oblivion record label. The only other record on that label was the Langston Hughes Memorial Eclectic Jazz Band. And it's why nobody knows about either record.
Good name for the record label, huh?
That's right. And there were 1,200 copies of those. And that was the first record. The Tacoma record was actually the second, if you exclude another one that I don't even name anymore. So mortifying.
Ah, dear. Speaking with Leo Kottke, he's going to be at the Crest Theater this coming Friday night, doing what he does best, performing in front of a live audience. And what makes that a thrilling experience for you? Because it must be fun just jamming with people, but there suddenly you're in front of 500 or 1,000 people, and what's that like?
But you get an empty head. You learn the value of that pretty quickly, and that's one of the one of the hooks of performance. You're not there. Some nights it's literally true. I'll remember going on, but I'll find myself standing backstage somewhere, kind of coming to. That's only happened twice, but it's exactly that. I have no recollection of where I just was or what I did. And it usually means that it was a great night, but who would know? I mean, how would I know? There is maybe 10% of yourself that sticks around when you perform to keep from walking off the front of the stage or et cetera, to kind of monitor, the autonomic systems. But that's it. You're gone. If you think or if you're self-aware while you're playing, it really messes with the playing. So it becomes just a really wonderful experience that way. To get there, you have to go through all of the nonsense about how it's done and what you think it should be or what you think you should be doing. And once you forget all of that, you disappear entirely. So for decades now, the only part of it that I don't like is about starts about 2 hours before you go on, because I just get depressed. I just start sliding down some horrible slope. And you hit bottom, you go on, and as you're walking out, you come up the other side only without yourself. It's really it's as predictable as anything. I've gotten very fond of it. It's a real privilege to play. And I'll have a couple hours of depressed every day.
Now, you mostly have recorded and performed by yourself, but you and Mike Gordon did a couple of projects together.
Yeah, and we'll probably do some more. The first two recordings kind of caught us unawares. We had a little more planning involved on the second one. And we've done two tours as a duo and one tour as a trio with the drummer I found, Neil Simonette, Bahamian drummer. And I guess it all happened because we're friends. And you just start playing because that's what we do. And started, I don't know, it just sort of took. We found ourselves in the studio without having told our respective labels or arranged financing for the thing. Got about half through before we thought we'd check the weather and see if they wanted it.
I guess having watched so many guitarists, I suspect, over the years, who's impressed you as being the very best guitarist that you've seen?
Well, everybody has a personal voice. It wouldn't be they wouldn't be out in the sound stream if they did. That's the central thing, and because it's personal, you can't compare Paco de Lucia to Paco Pena, for example, or Pepe or Romero to Walter Gerwig, but there are, and it doesn't either boil down to just virtuosity. I'd say just virtuosity, but it doesn't boil down to that, because that too is subject to my experience, and just how it hits me. There'd be a long list, but right up at the top of it are people like John McLaughlin and Paco de Lucia and Jimmy Rainey. Jimmy Rainey isn't that well known in general these days, but he had this quality that you didn't hear in his playing until he was in Stan Getz's quintet. And when he was playing with Stan Getz, you heard something that is pretty irresistible. Hmm. I think that's what it, in the end, that's what it comes down to for me, is whether it's a pleasure to hear someone, whether they get in there and wake you up and move you around and kind of take over your brainstem. That's a rare thing, and those players do it all the time. There are other players who play rings around those guys, but they don't wake you up. It isn't necessarily that much fun to hear them.
What about remembering people you've played guitar with? Is there any one jam session that or maybe a couple of them that stick out as being something that put a grin across your face that never went away? Or something?
Oh, well, yeah. It always gets you that way, even if it's not working. And there are a lot of situations though where you don't want to do it at all and shouldn't. There's a kind of assumption on the part of promoters that any guitar player would want to play with any other guitar player. And they'll force you into situations where you have to. And I can tell you that there is not one guitar player out there, well, maybe one, who wants to do that, because it's a train wreck. And there's a whole tradition behind that kind of imperative that developed the guitar as something you played like a horn, which is generally attributed to Charlie Christian and the electric pickup, or the guitar pickup. But it's a very rational approach as well if you have to play with other people. You find the register that's not being occupied by the other instruments, and you play your instrument in a line, like a horn, so that you don't step on people. But before that happened, there were people like Teddy Bunn or Snoozer Quinn, I've never known how to pronounce his last name, Aleman or Aileman, or the guys who would play with their entire right hand. Rosetta Tharpe, I think, also started this way. But you couldn't hear it. If you could, it would get in the way of the rhythm section or the horn section. So there's all kinds of compromises when it comes to playing with other people. I think the guitar really is a solo instrument. It can be annoying for other players to have a guitar in there.
Have you ever thought?
I see. I've done it.
Have you ever thought about writing like a history of sort of modern guitar playing?
No, because despite my pretensions here, I'm pretty ignorant about it. It is really a mysterious curve to find out how it developed, where it is, and who is there. You know, people keep floating up, both from 100 years ago or 50 years ago, that no one knew about, and that are found later on. And it isn't entirely because of recording. A good example of that would be, I've blocked on his name now. He's been forgotten again. Shoot, can't think of him. But Snoozer Quinn has a chance of having a larger audience because his great niece is doing her doctoral thesis on him. And she's been scouring the dregs of the guitar crowd to find somebody who might know him. The dregs being occupied by people who are not there by virtue of their playing, but by virtue of their age. Snoozer he operated with Big Spiderbeck, people like that. So he's getting the public's getting a refresher course in Snoozer, and he's an extraordinary guy to hear. There's one recording of him that was made on his deathbed when he was dying of tuberculosis in 1952. By a cornet player named Johnny Wiggins, who didn't care that he was dying, just wanted to get that guitar down there. And we have him to thank for it, him and his golf.
Well, and one last question before we let you go, Leo, and that is, do you have a guitar technician, or do you take care of your guitars on tour yourself?
Oh, on tour I do it myself. I've got a couple wrenches, and I still carry a pocket knife. And there isn't much that, if it requires a real repairman, you can't do it yourself. It's just too much. But you have to do your own tweaking, or you'll be lost. That's one of the reasons that I play a couple of signature model guitars that are made by a factory, because I can get another one quickly when the airline decides they need it more than I do. And they do.
I can imagine. And that, yeah, that's true, because if, yeah, because we know you do some singing, but you probably wouldn't want to do an a cappella concert.
No, I would last about 5 minutes, and it'd be fun to try. Actually, I have a cappella, but with other people.
Okay.
I have sung, but you're right, and it's the 12 string that really have to have. I wish that wasn't so. Then I'd only have to carry one guitar around. I believe in the power to weight ratio, and carrying two guitars violates its principles.
I see. Hey, well, we thank you very much for joining us here today, Leo.
Thanks for talking to me, and we'll see you at the Crest.
That's right, the Crest Theater, this coming Friday night. Tickets available at tickets.com or at the Crest box office. And, Leo, we thank you very much for taking time out for your schedule. And safe travels, and safe travels with those guitars as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Same to you.
All right. KVMR-FM, Nevada City, Leo Kottke.